Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And today's program, we're going to be exploring inventors. They're not mothers, though. They're all sons, the men.
three inventors, all guys. We haven't had an all-guy program for quite a while. Let's hear it, guys. But seriously, folks, inventions take place in some of the most unlikely places. And we've been surprised recently, although we have seen this trend just a little bit, which is a new enthusiasm for an alcoholic liquor made from apples called cider.
I don't think you can actually call it an invention, can you?
Well, I think you can call it seriously reinventing a drink called cider, which is associated with perhaps rather insipid drinking, and instead cider that comes presented in full-size bottles like champagne bottles.
He'll explain, actually.
Yes, of course.
He'll explain that it's a tradition that never went away, actually, in parts of Europe. It just did in the United States. The Angry Orchard is one of the prime examples of the new cider, the new American cider. I've been hearing a great deal about a cider renaissance in the United States, and at the center of that is the Angry Orchard. And we're going to be talking to the owner and operator of Angry Orchard, David Sipes, about his company, his history, and overall the products that he produces. David, tell me, is there, or did I just imagine it, all of a sudden, a great deal of activity in the United States surrounding the consumption, the production and consumption of cider. Hard cider, now we're talking, right?
Yes, hard cider. I did, however, want to clarify, and unfortunately, I'm not the owner of Angry Orchard, just a proud cider maker.
Oh, okay. All right. I think you're the chief cider maker.
That is correct. That is correct.
And who owns it? Is it a family-owned business?
Angry Orchard is part of the Boston Beer Company, Samuel Adams.
Oh, okay.
They don't feel like traitors. In my native land, I guess hard cider and beer are seen as competing drinks. I guess Boston Beer Company must think they're complementary drinks.
You know, it's a very interesting point. I think cider is... This whole discussion started about a bit of a renaissance, and I think cider in the United States is widely unknown, and to many drinkers, they're not even aware of what cider is all about. And those that have some knowledge of it, it's largely perceived as beer. It's something that's consumed in a pint glass at a pub. And part of the really exciting thing about this renaissance is cider's really breaking out and seeing a whole lot of other occasions to enjoy cider. We're seeing food and cider pairing opportunities, and really just it's occupying a space between beer and wine and cocktails, and it's really just fun and exciting time to be a cider maker. Drinkers have sophisticated palates, and they're interested in new flavors and new things, and cider's really providing just a new flavor experience and an alternative to wine, alternative to beer, alternative to cocktails, and it's really met with a great response in the United States so far. Still a very small piece of the overall beverage market.
How do you become a cider, if there hasn't been much cider made, how do you become a cider maker?
Well, my personal background, I studied fermentation science at the University of California at Davis and graduated from there and then went into craft brewing for a while. I've actually had jobs in the wine industry in Napa Valley, craft brewing on both coasts, and had the opportunity here to work with Angry Orchard. And just a little more about Angry Orchard and sort of where we came from. It's a product of a singular goal of just crafting distinctive, refreshing cider of the highest quality. We've been at this for about 15 years.
Wow.
Tinkering with different apple varieties and visiting growers, studying cider-making methods at places where still a strong culture of cider. And while relatively new in the U.S., there are regions of the world where cider is still a really big part of the culture. And
like Spain, Basque country in Spain.
Absolutely. The Basques are making some wonderfully interesting and unique ciders. Herefordshire in the U.K. and Normandy and Brittany in France are all areas where there's still a really strong understanding of what cider is supposed to be. It's an important aspect of Angry Orchard as well. The search for sort of the best apples and the best ingredients led us to Europe, and We make all our Angry Orchard ciders out of a blend of culinary apples from the foothills of the Alps in the Sud Tyrol region, or the terroir, just abundant sunshine, long days and cool nights, produce a really unique apple. These are apple varieties there that are common and familiar, Red Delicious, Golden Delicious, Gala Fuji, Braeburn, things of that nature. So all apples that people would be familiar with, but the climate there really creates a distinct acidity and brightness to it that we think is just wonderful for producing ciders. In addition to the culinary apples, we use bittersweet varieties from Normandy and Brittany and in a sort of northwest corner of France. And the important distinction there is these are heirloom varieties that are bred and selected specific for the production of cider. These are cider-making apples. And unlike the more common varieties, really unique flavor profiles, stringency, tannins, and polyphenols, the same sort of things a winemaker would be looking for, we're looking for in the apples as well. And the bittersweet varieties provide that complexity. And that's an important distinction because as cider went away in the United States pre-prohibition, so did the apple, a lot of the apples that were intended for cider making. So it's really important to us that we go get fruit that was intended to be made into cider.
And that's interesting. So cider itself was a casualty of prohibition, just like wine and liquor. I never knew that.
Yeah, you know, the history of it is, I think, not as clear or understood as wine, beer, and liquor because there wasn't a really strong established cider industry, per se. But dating back to colonial times, every farm and every village, they were making cider. At the harvest time, they would take what they could make for pies, eat what they could, and the rest of it would be turned into cider. But it certainly went by the wayside around Prohibition.
Now, there are two distinct parts of your product portfolio. And you wanted to start with one of them, and then we'll move on to the other one, and we're actually going to taste some as we go along.
Yeah, absolutely. The what we refer to sort of as the core family for Angry Orchard consists of three different flavors, and we set out using different ratios of the culinary and the bittersweet and different juices and different profiles. We've been able to create three distinctly different ciders that all offer something unique. Attempt there is to just really create ciders that appeal to people that are familiar with cider, have been drinking cider for years, know what it's all about, all the way up to maybe introduce new drinkers to cider. The crisp apple, Angry Orchard Crisp, luscious, fruit forward, very juicy, complemented by a nice bright acidity at the end. And this just a really nice, approachable, easy drinking cider. That's really shaping up to be the most popular of the bunch. And I think it's because of the approachability of it, the very slight sweetness, yet balanced with the acidity, really appeals to a lot of drinkers. Apple ginger is similar structurally. It's got a lot of luscious, fruit-forward, apple juicy notes, but it's complemented with Nigerian ginger. And this puts
Nigerian
some ginger.
Nigerian ginger? I never even knew it came from Nigeria.
Yeah, it's somewhat sweet flavor profile, but has the heat and spiciness of ginger. So you get a initial impression of apples, like biting into a fresh, juicy apple, but there's this heat that comes on, very pleasant, that complements that sweetness and finishes really kind of dry and clean. That one, really interesting pairing with foods. I just love it with barbecue, with a pulled pork sandwich or something. It's just a wonderful accompaniment. And the
ginger has been predicted to be one of the leading flavors for 2013.
Is it? I was not aware of that. I just found it to really be a good complement to the apple sweetness, kind of having that sweet and spicy note. It just seems to they play well, really well together. The other one in the Angry Orchard family is that we're really happy with, and it's my personal favorite, is the traditional dry. And as the name might suggest, it's a more traditional flavor profile. It's patterned after English pub draft ciders. Much drier on the palate. It's made with a higher inclusion of the sort of bittersweet varieties, so it has a little bit of an earthy, herbal quality to it. Definite flavor of apple and cider up front, bright, fresh apple, but finishes dry, clean, and somewhat astringent, though positively so. And this really, I think it goes great with food. I would pair that with any kind of seafood dishes. It goes great with risottos and cheeses and stuff to clean the palate. A lot of similarities to like a dry New World Sauvignon Blanc or something. So I've really been happy with that one.
Now, I mean, you probably have profiles. Who are the big new aficionados of cider coming on board? Do you have a profile of who you market?
No, we really don't. From a drinker perspective, from a consumer perspective, we see it doesn't necessarily skew heavily male or female. whereas traditionally craft beer, for instance, seems to be more male-oriented. We're not seeing that with cider, so it seems, from a demographics perspective, really seem to appeal to a wide range of drinkers. And it's difficult, since it's still so unknown, to really say there's even this group of aficionados coming out of it. It's only really been, as an industry, a few months since we've had an industry of joining of the minds. The United States Association of Cider Makers, established in February prior to a conference in Chicago, and that was just a place where the industry kind of got together, and cider makers and owners of cider plants and such were to raise awareness about cider, to educate consumers and really gain alignment on how to approach this and make cider more known. It's really just kind of gotten together as an industry. So it'll be interesting to see what shakes out of that.
Now, this core collection of flavors is pretty widely available across the United States, correct?
Yes, it is. It's just over a year that we rolled those out nationally. The whole Angry Orchard family didn't come out until the end of 2011. Roughly fall, we launched in the Northeast and a couple other select markets. And based on the response from drinkers, we elected last spring to roll it out. So it's been just over a year that we've been out, and the response from cider drinkers has just been fantastic.
Well, now, have you any sort of estimate at how many members you have now in this cider society?
You know, I don't. I apologize. I don't have any key facts to that. I was involved in some initial discussions around it, and I'd be happy to chase that down and try and...
Yeah, I'm just sort of trying to figure out how widespread this, keep calling the cider renaissance, is.
Sure. Well, the association have members from small farmstead operations to larger cider makers, and your representation from the mid-Atlantic to the Pacific Northwest and all points in between. So definitely has a good geographic spread, as well as all sizes, shapes and sizes of cider makers in the industry. So.
And generally geographically, I guess, following mostly where the apples are.
Absolutely. And that's also where we're finding awareness, too, up in the Pacific Northwest and in the Midwest to an extent, New England, New York, and down around the mid-Atlantic, Virginia, and areas like that are where apples have been grown for a long time, and there may be a little more awareness, cider industry of sorts, of cider. So
now you've got a different product line altogether, which is, I guess, much more select and really unusual to look at, exciting, I think, to look at. A wonderful hostess gift, just because of how good it looks, not just how good it tastes. Talk to us about Iceman and Strawman and all those guys.
Absolutely. Well, part of this renaissance is about educating drinkers about what cider can be, and that path is really about new styles and new flavors. And while cider has a history back into the U.S. around colonial times, and people are kind of, to some extent, rediscovering the roots of cider, it's kind of like drinking from a fire hose of getting cider in the hands of drinkers. But we're finding just this curiosity, this quest for discovery of new flavors and new ciders and what else is out there. So the drinkers are really, much like the craft beer industry was 25 years ago, cider drinkers are really clamoring for new and interesting things. So the Cider House collection was sort of our interpretation of a couple traditional styles and an effort to really educate drinkers a little more about what cider can be, about some flavors, about some styles that are out there. Angry Orchard Iceman is patterned after ice ciders of Quebec, and it exhibits notes of caramel and toffee, honey and vanilla. A little bit sweet up front. The process is freezing the juice prior to fermentation, and that results in a concentration of flavors and of sugars. So it's very flavorful, luscious, juicy, fruit-forward, a little bit sweet. There is some unfermented apple juice in there, but the acidity really balances that out, and it finishes clean, bright, with a good snap. And it to me, is like biting into a fresh green apple. Complements cheeses very well. Goes with mimolet or any kind of camembert, soft white cheese and such. Really wonderful with foie gras. It's a little bit decadent.
Yeah, it would be perfect, wouldn't it? Yeah.
That acidity just really cleans the palate and does a wonderful job. Strawman, a little more of a nod to more traditional farmhouse styles that you'd find in the countryside of France or the UK. It's difficult to refer to these as a style per se, because they're all so different. There's not a broad industry making farmhouse ciders. These are, as the name would suggest, farmhouses making their ciders with their harvest for the year. But nevertheless, we really wanted to kind of showcase those flavors and that characteristic. Bright apples up front, a little bit citrus. It does have a much higher percentage of the bittersweet apple varieties, so these traditional apple varieties, which themselves have an earthy, herbal complexity to them. There really is a nice complement to that. And this finishes with floral notes of honeysuckle and vanilla. So, again, a lot of nice complexity to it. I find that I can't help but use wine-like descriptors when I'm describing
ciders. Yeah, you do. I know.
Well, I was going to comment that, in fact, this is a rather fascinating, if you like, a champagne replacement, if you want to really surprise your guests and put a smile on their face after they realize that they're drinking cider, which they probably never drank before.
Yeah, no, it's true. And, you know, bear in mind that cider is more wine-like than beer-like. And while from a drinking occasion perspective and a serving perspective, I think most of U.S. drinkers would kind of associate cider more with beer, it's fermented apple juice at the end of the day. We're using yeast strains that have origins in wine, and we're really looking for some of the same flavor characteristics that a winemaker would. Strawman, it definitely says apples and says cider, but finishes very, very dry with the complexity of the bittersweet apples and a subtle bready note. Again, very similar to champagne. I find a lot of the characteristics that I can't help but grasping for some of these descriptors that I would also use for describing wines.
I think the straw man
also just a great compliment with foods. Goes wonderfully on its own as well.
Now, one of the most exciting things about these two wines, aside from, of course, the wonderful flavor package that's inside the bottle, is the glamorous bottles in which they're presented. I mean, these two Straw Man and Ice Man come in very, very special packaging.
Absolutely. We wanted to put these wanted to showcase them as special ciders. So they're all packaged in 750 milliliter cork-finished bottles, again, very similar to what a champagne would be like. That's part for aesthetics and stylistic reasons, but also they tend to be a little higher in carbonation than more conventional ciders would, so we also need that more robust package to contain the carbonation. They do have higher alcohol, which always brings flavors and complexity as well.
I'm really excited about them.
Yeah, but who designed those wonderful bottles? I mean, the bottles themselves are works of art.
Thank you. Yeah, we've got a small group of creative folks that are always working on something that exhibits their persona of Angry Orchard, personality behind it.
Are you tempted at all to venture into the even harder realm of like a Calvados?
So far, no. You know, Calvados, much of our apples, particularly the ones Normandy and Brittany,
yeah,
the French bittersweet, absolutely. Some of my competitors for sourcing the fruit, for buying apples, are Calvados producers, so they're looking for a lot of the same kind of characteristics. For the time being, our focus is really on making refreshing, interesting ciders, and no intent to go into the distilled spirit side of things.
And you don't have to pour them from 6 feet up, like they do in the Basque country.
Yeah, I imagine they have a high. They probably waste a lot of cider there pouring it like that.
They do it aerated or something. I never did understand it. Do you know anything about it?
I don't know a whole lot about what it actually does from a scientific perspective. But, yeah, I think there's sort of an aeration going on in complexity, much like you would see with decanting wines and things like that. I don't know if you need a 6-foot stream to accomplish that.
I don't think I could make that one.
I'm guessing it's the kind of thing you do better after you've drunk a great deal more cider.
That's one of the really fun things about cider as well, is just this localized, little-known regions of tradition like that. Most cider drinkers, or most drinkers in general, unaware of cider, and even cider drinkers unaware of these little small region in France where they're pumping out really complex, interesting ciders.
Well, we thank you so much, David, for joining us. Angry Orchard is a fascinating story, and I sense it's a story that's only just beginning. You'll have to come back at us in 2 or 3 years and let us know what else is new in Angry Orchard land.
Absolutely. Would love to have the opportunity. Thanks for having us on, and looking forward to talking more. We have... it's been a fun ride this last year and watching the industry grow. See a lot more opportunities out there to educate drinkers on what cider is and what cider can be. So looking forward to it. It's a fun time to be a cider maker.
Yeah, you sound like you're having fun.
Well, absolutely.
What do we say? Do you still say cheers after drinking a glass of cider?
Yes. So cheers is always appropriate.
Okay.
And cheers to you, David, and your entire team at Angry Orchard.
Thank you.
It's time to take a break, but we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. The next guest is, in fact, an inventor. He never stops thinking of new ways of doing things and new products to develop. It's too bad that we could not worm out of him the thing he's working on. This could be such a revelation, but we tried. Anyhow, let's talk to Rio Sabadici about his last invention, which is a whiskey aerator or a spirits aerator.
Yeah, sort of like what happens when an engineer beats a glass of bourbon. He doesn't just drink it.
The last time we spoke with Rio Sabadici was in 2009, and he had just invented and created, designed, the wine aerators, one for white and one for red. Much to our surprise, we got notice that, in fact, there is a new member of the Venturi family, and it is a spirits aerator. Rio, welcome to On the Menu yet again. And we want to know, just bring us up to date, as how did this all start? When did you found this company, or how did you think of it?
The Venturi company, the product was first made available in October of 2006. So really 2007 was our launch year, and it's been going gangbusters since.
But what gave you the idea? I mean, do you sit around thinking of is this the only kind of device you've ever designed?
I have invented software before, but that's not too exciting.
No.
The Venturi, are you asked about the wine aerator or the spirit aerator?
Well, both, I guess, all. The company.
Okay. Well, the wine aerator was the first time I drank properly aerated wine. I couldn't believe how much better it became. That each glass was so much better than the glass before that an hour later, what started out thin and okay became rich and creamy and delicious. And I thought, that's aeration. And I set out to speed up the process. I tried two different approaches before and then got the idea of a Venturi. And I thought, that's physics 101. I know a Venturi. And then I set about creating the product.
Now, you told us when we talked to you before, and I thought this was very interesting, that one of the first places you tried to sell it was up and down Highway 29 in Napa Valley, and everybody bought one.
Yes, I thought the first thing we need to do is establish credibility, and the best way to do that is with the Napa wineries. So we went up there, and it was pretty much an instant hit.
Plus, they've got a problem that you don't necessarily have at home, in that they're going to open a fresh bottle for you to taste a lot of the time, and you don't have an hour and a half to sit around to wait for it to aerate in a decanter.
Exactly.
I mean, you didn't even know that need existed, did you, until you actually went to see them all?
I did, because some wineries try to predict how many visitors they're going to have that day, and they try and open and aerate so there's enough aerated wine. But inevitably, they end up throwing a lot of wine away.
Hmm. Well, maybe they don't throw it away, but they don't sell it to paying customers, I guess.
Well, so what have you been doing between 2007 and 2013, then?
A lot of it was keeping up with Venturi's growth. We went from zero to a $25 million company in 3 years.
Wow.
And just had to build the staff and just had to do everything involved with that. And then I've been doing some inventing in the meantime also.
Okay, now the next up was the spirits aerator?
Correct.
And how did that come about?
Well, one day I tried pouring scotch through the red wine Venturi, and I was surprised that it became much more tasteful. That I could taste more flavors that were hidden before. All the flavors balanced better. The whole experience of taking a sip was more enjoyable. And the finish was much longer, extended, balanced, and enjoyable. Then I tried different alcohols because I was amazed that it would have that big a difference on scotch. And to my amazement, everything I tried, even clear liquors such as vodka and gin, became more flavorful and more enjoyable.
Now, it's interesting. So you started out with a principle that worked with wine, but you weren't sure it would work with scotch, and then you found out that it did. But then you had to be smarter yet. So rather than just selling a whole lot more red wine aerators, you did some fine-tuning to produce a product that was optimized for liquor.
That's correct. For example, you don't want to pour expensive scotch or cognac or port or something like that through a red wine venturi. And I didn't want anything other than our material touching the liquor. I also wanted a simple mechanism that wouldn't break, was easy to clean. So I invented a magnetic valve that's closed so you can pour your favorite spirit in. And in the top bowl is an integrated jigger with lines for 1, 1.5, and 2 ounces. So you can measure slowly and carefully exactly how much you want. Then you hold it over your glass and press a button, and that turns a magnet which releases the magnetic valve, which allows the spirits to come through and aerate directly into your glass.
But you also had to do something else to the aeration. You had to modify that slightly as well, you told us.
That's correct. So it's a bit of a technical term. It's called viscosity, and alcohols are more viscous than wine, so we had to tweak the aeration for liquors.
Who did you have in mind for your market? Individuals? I mean, you started out with winemakers for the wine aerators, but who were you aiming for, bartenders?
Well, I was aiming for home use.
Okay.
I was aiming for people that liked drinking primarily their liquors neat, although we have found a difference with, like, gin and tonics and martinis. That was a primary focus.
Now, what about bartenders? I would think that would be a heavenly market for you.
That's called on-premise, and it turns out to be a pretty tough thing to break into, in that the restaurant usually dictates how the bar is going to run, and then it's quite difficult to get them to change.
Right, so at some point I guess they might, but you weren't relying on that as your primary market.
No. So it is being used, so Venturi Spirit is being used in some restaurants, but not widely. We're still working on it.
Yeah, now, I mean, what kinds of responses have you been getting? Could you say that one spirit works better than another, or are they all equal, or what kind of response do you have?
Well, I've been to some tastings, and the results have just been overwhelming. And these tastings have people in the industry, kind of industry leader types, and just everybody is blown away by the improvement in taste. Now, we're talking about taste, and it's hard to put that into words. So the most common word I've heard is wow.
Uh-huh. You know, I imagine that it would be, you could say, a boom and a bust. I mean, it would be a boom or a boon for fine liquors, but if you had a bad bottle or something, it really would probably just accelerate the evil-tasting stuff in this booze, right?
That's absolutely correct. The more the specific spirit has to offer, the more will come through.
So you're saying fine vintage cognac is probably the absolutely the most affected?
Every cognac I've tried has improved.
And what are you generally? You're a scotch drinker?
I kind of waver. I don't really stick with one, kind of what I'm in the mood for.
Okay.
I think my three favorites are scotch, cognac, and red wine.
Okay. That's, you and I have similar tastes, I think. And Stilton cheese, right?
Of course.
You're not an inventor. I can't seem to get my head around this whole thing about you design software and all of a sudden you're inventing gadgets.
Life is strange, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's like Edison. Edison invented all kinds of different things.
Uh-huh.
I mean, what did he start out inventing? I can't remember. He didn't invent the telephone, but I guess he was close.
That was Alexander Graham.
But he invented a whole lot of things, and he didn't seem to be tied to one particular field. So you're like that too, I guess.
Yes, I have a degree in engineering.
Oh, you
do? And I guess it just shows.
Okay, so what kind of engineering is your degree in?
Electrical.
Wow. Yeah, I guess I can see it, how it would relate. I'm trying to figure out how I can ask you, how I can get you to tell us. We know you're already working on something else, and we know that most likely you will tell us. But can't you give us a little hint? Is it another wine, spirit, or some such beverage?
Gadget?
A thing for that? Or is it a wholly different field?
It's for wine, and it's not an aerator.
Okay.
Okay.
It must be a bottle. Or it's a stopper.
Well, you know, we actually, I don't know if you know the, is it Eich or Esch people? Do you know them? They send us a whole set of those glasses. But the other glassmakers, who are they?
We were at a tasting being given by a representative from Riedel.
Who's sort of in
No, you did. You came right out and said the Irish people are liars.
Yeah.
there's no such thing as breathable glass.
So, I mean, who to trust in this? I actually thought that the stuff tasted better in the Irish glass. But on the other hand, I think that the Riedel has over designed for, I mean, there are different glasses for Australian wines, but, there's no denying that in this tasting, the Chardonnay glass was amazing, how much better the Chardonnay tasted. I'm not a Chardonnay drinker in general, in one of the Chardonnay glasses and so forth. But where do you stand? Does Esch make breathable glass that would actually refute your aerator? What a question.
Well, since both products have similar aims, I don't think it's fair for me to comment on a competitor.
Fair enough.
Well, that's very circumspect of you.
Well, how soon are you going to come back and tell us about your latest invention?
That's the problem with inventing. You never know when you're going to finish.
Yeah.
Well, it always takes longer than you think. And as you can tell by my products, I'm a perfectionist.
The little stand that goes with the aerator, best of all. I think it's so cute.
Anyway, be sure to come back at us when you're ready.
I mean, we didn't say how does anybody get these aerators.
Oh, right. We didn't, did we? Well, I'll put the website on the program description.
Can they get them through your website?
Yes, they're at our website at venturi.com and also available at Bed Bath Beyond.
Oh, Bed Bath Beyond, huh?
No.
And let me go through the list of alcohols that it's been tested with.
Okay.
So we've already mentioned scotch, cognac, port, tequila, whiskey, bourbon, vodka, gin, rum, brandy, sake, and liqueurs.
Oh, well, you know, we have some, what's this stuff we got?
Cachaca.
Cachaca.
Well, that's
we could try that.
That's rum. I mean, that's really what that is.
Tastes a bit like grappa.
Tastes a little bit like rotgut. But yeah. But your Venturi will fix it. Your Venturi will smooth it out.
No, and he said what I suggested is it might accentuate the bad qualities as opposed to cover them up.
I think, Rio, you're a great humanitarian. You're providing a wonderful service of thinking of things that people can buy for their friends who like to drink.
Can't be all bad. Great gift. So people are always thinking, you know, what do I get this person? Well, if they like drinking scotch, cognac, etc., this makes a perfect gift and would be well appreciated.
We're giving one away tomorrow night.
Yes. And somebody is retiring and it's a survival kit for retirement. And it's going to be matched up with a little bottle of bourbon.
Perfect.
Yes.
Anyway.
So it's good for gifts, listeners.
Anyway, go back to the lab. And keep inventing and keep on letting us know what you're up to, Rio.
Okay. Thank you very much. It was great speaking with you again.
Yeah, Rio. Good to talk to you. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
And we'll be back with another innovator right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, this next guy, you never know what he's up to next. The cogs turn continuously in his head. We're talking about Mark Bitterman, who is the owner of The Meadow, which is currently in two locations, about to get a third location. But we're going to be talking to him about his newest book called Salt Block Cooking, which you might think is an old form of cooking, but in fact, he invented pretty much everything about it. And guess what else we know? He's using these beautiful Mongolian saw blocks, which don't even come from Mongolia.
Yeah, they come from, they called him Himalayan. They don't even come from the Himalayas either.
Oh, the Himalayan.
Never
I said
mind.
Mongolia.
Mongolia, Himalayas. Who cares? They come from Pakistan, believe it or not.
They come from Pakistan.
Via Poland, Oregon. What can I tell you?
Yeah.
And there's more to this than meets the eye. So be sure to listen carefully.
Mark Bitterman is always a surprise. He's the author of the James Beard Award-winning book called Salted. That was his last book. He's out with an arrestingly themed book called Salt Block Cooking. And I think, Mark, you're going to start off by telling us exactly what a salt block is and why it's as important as you indicated in your preface to your book.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here. A salt block is a slab of ancient Himalayan salt that's basically cut out of a mountain range in Pakistan and cut into chunks and blocks and bricks and slabs of all different sizes. So it's a solid block of ancient salt that then you can use in the kitchen sort of as a cooking implement in any way that you might imagine. So you can take a salt block and you can use it at room temperature and just put some cheeses and fruits on there, and it will delicately season your food just by imparting some of the salt from itself into the food as the food sits on it.
You see, I don't understand why you need to have salt in a whole bunch of foods. Mm-hmm. I mean, why would you need salt and cheese?
Sure. Great. So the simplest answer to that question is try a slice of mozzarella with some salt on it and try a piece of mozzarella without some salt on it and ask yourself which one you prefer. It's a cheese that is made with salt but is undersalted and it comes alive with a little bit of sea salt on top of it or any other type of salt on it. So a really delicious thing to do with some mozzarella is you slice it thin or thick and interweave it with some tomatoes and or some boxed pears or something like that, and the fruit picks up some salt and the sugars get amplified and the flavors become accentuated from the salt, and the mozzarella becomes richer and more dairy and more luscious, and so those flavors get amplified and you have a radically tastier salad.
Now, you didn't invent cooking with salt blocks. It presumably has a historical evolution.
That's always a little bit of a letdown for me. I sure wish it did. The truth is that it's actually a fairly new innovation, and it's almost certainly an American one. I've looked into this question myself for some while and have not found a definitive answer of the first person to use salt blocks in a cooking application. But they are a new contemporary idea in cooking.
So they don't actually cook on salt blocks in Pakistan. They just make them for you.
Correct. They do not use them in Pakistan for cooking on. It is possible that some of the old salt rocks may have been heated on a fire and food thrown on them in sort of a Berber setting sort of situation, but that's undocumented. And I've personally spoken with a number of food historians and with a number of Pakistanis, and all accounts are that all Himalayan salt that's ever used in Pakistan has been ground up and used to serve as any traditional salt.
Now, I don't want to be cynical about this, but could it be that the reason you're so fascinated with cooking and otherwise using salt blocks, because we'll talk about more things you could do with them than just cooking, is that you have bought a whole bunch of salt blocks, and they were a hard sell.
They're a hard sell? Is that what you said?
Yeah. I mean, they are very attractive. I saw them years ago when they first showed up at the Fancy Food Show. It was sort of the next step from fancy salts. And you, by the way, are a sommelier, which is a salt a salt sommelier, right? Is that the way to describe it?
It's sort of like a sommelier, but for salt.
Right. And you have two stores that they're both called The Meadow. One is in Portland, Oregon. The other one's in New York City. And you do sell salts, all kinds of salts, and salt blocks, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
We have about 150 different kinds of different salts from all over the world, and Himalayan salts, and just sort of a whole smattering. It really kind of just a cross-section of what's out there in the world for salt.
So, but did you just have this idea that here are these beautiful things and maybe you should find a good way to use them?
that's a really, really natural way that it, I guess, might come about. I did first find them and just find them to be, like, visually incredibly arresting and tactile and beautiful. They're heavy and luminous and gorgeous, and they almost, like, resonate. And so I was really drawn to them. And I think that actually frankly was a little bit of an impetus for me to explore them a little bit more. I had seen people doing some kind of basic cooking techniques for them, like putting a piece of beef tartare on there or heating them up and cooking some shrimp on there. There's some very basic ideas, which are wonderful, and I was impressed by that. But it was, to a certain extent, the massive visual and sensual impact of the salt itself that inspired me. And so I did. I actually... I did explore, and I found that the more I did with them, the more impressed I was. A great example would be like duck breast, like something that has a lot of fat. You can cook it slow and even on a salt block, and you get this incredible, rich, deep flavor out of it, and you also get this crispy, salty skin out of it. And it's a cooking technique. I've eaten a lot of duck because I lived in the south of France for years. It's a cooking technique that makes the best dang duck I've ever eaten in my life. Hmm. So it was this kind of process of just one step after another. Another good example would be when I started to use the salt blocks more for curing. I started with things like gravlaks, like heavy, fatty, rich fish. And it's a super easy recipe to do. Basically, it's just the salt blocks, some dill, some brown sugar, some salmon, some brown sugar, a dill, and some salt block. And you just wrap it up in a plastic bag, stick it in the fridge, and 3 days later you have God's gift to gravlaks. But you can go way farther than that. I started to use, for example, thin slices of vegetables and fruits and other kinds of meats, and I got these incredible curing results that I've never seen replicated by any other cooking technique.
Now, why is it that the salt block itself affects way above and beyond what actually salting the product would create?
So a variety of reasons. One of them is, for example, in the curing application, it's a little counterintuitive, but it's funny. The normal way you cure with salt is you put a granular salt on top of food, and that granular salt dissolves somewhat and pulls a ton of the moisture out of the food and helps to dehydrate it, and also, of course, imparts some salt. With a salt block, you have a solid mass, a two-dimensional crystal. It's just one big surface on the surface of the food. And so it's actually less surface area than granular salt, which has got a million different little dimensions and facets
right,
to it.
Yeah.
So when you're putting a solid block of salt on top of a piece of food, the gravlaks is a great example. And so gravlaks can come off as kind of mealy, a little bit dry, a little bit, the texture isn't so perfect. And, of course, too salty. With a salt block, you have this firm, lush, perfectly textured, moist gravlaks that you can't achieve by using granular salt.
No.
On the other cooking applications, it's even a greater distinction. For example, when you heat the salt blocks up on the stovetop, get them up to 500 degrees or so, and then throw food on top of them. Now you throw some scallops or some steak or some eggs or whatever you like on top of, or, you know, Bellini batter, right on top of the hot salt block. And you have both the salt and the heat reacting with the food simultaneously to cook it. And it creates flavor and texture that you can't get otherwise. And a really good example is when I was writing my book, I hired a food stylist, and a food stylist is a funny thing. It's a person whose job is to help you kind of prepare the food and put it on a plate in a pretty way so you can take a pretty photograph of it. And I'm a good cook and all that, but maybe not always the prettiest cook, so I figured I would get this help.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very specialized field, yeah.
It's a specialized field, and they do a great job. So my food stylist says, well, what I would like to do is take those scallops that we're going to use in the photograph, and I want to sear them off in the pan so I get that patina, because I'm worried that I won't be able to get the patina you want on the salt blocks. And I said, well, you're the professional. Do whatever you like. Mm-hmm. So this woman goes through maybe $80 worth of these fantastic diver scallops trying to get the patina that keeps coming back to get this gorgeous, crusty, rich crust on the surface of the scallop. And I'm like, no, that's nothing like my scallops. Do it again. And so finally we're like, forget it. Let's do it on the salt block. And in one go on the salt block, we had the most incredible, moist, but crusty, chewy exterior scallops with that salty crust that you've ever tasted. And it was easy peasy. It was quick. And it was, in a sense, like the natural way to do it.
Now, if I just to back up a second, because I wanted to ask this question a little bit earlier, and you sort of answered a good deal of it, but not necessarily all of it. So some of the techniques in your book involve the food on the bottom and the salt block on top. And then others, you heat the salt block and you use it from below.
Or you can also chill it, too.
And presumably you do the same with when you're using it as a cheese plate, like you were talking about earlier on. You would have the salt block below and the cheese on top.
Yes, exactly. So it's that in the book I've actually broken it down by technique, and that's one of the real innovations I think of the book is just to actually look at all different facets of the salt block. And so it could simply be that it has a thermal mass to it. For example, if you use it as a frozen block of salt, you can do one thing with it. If you use it at room temperature, it can be used in a different way. If you can use it in the curing applications, it's actually the physical weight of the salt block itself that also contributes as a factor. If you heat it, then it's to a very high temperature, then it's the saltiness and its thermal mass that does something. If you just make it warm, it's something different. And so what I loved about writing this book was actually it gave me an opportunity to kind of more systematically explore every single kind of physical and chemical and aesthetic property of salt and exploit it to its maximum effect to give you the most flavor, the most fun, and the most beautiful, most beautifully presented food.
It's really fascinating. Now, we have, I guess, seen block salt before, right? Now, it's what I would call rock salt, correct?
No.
Yes. Yes and no.
Okay.
Well, do the
yes and no for me then.
Some rock salt is actually just is a any kind of an evaporated salt that's crystallized in big chunky crystals.
Yeah, it's like what you cook oysters on the half shell in if you're going to bake them.
Well, the distinction that I'm making, if you will, because I'm a bit of a geologist somewhere in my background, is that. This is salt which is mined underground rather than evaporated at the seashore or in the case of mass production.
You put your finger on it.
Mass produced salt for chemical use in England, for example, where I grew up, they don't actually mine the rock salt, but they pump water into the place where the rock salt is. And as a result, they leached it out. So essentially, they're giving the rock salt a hot water bath and then pumping it out and then drying it and grinding it to make table salt.
Yeah, so most of the rock salt that you see out there, like you're saying, for oysters or for hot water softeners, all that kind of stuff, is generally a salt that's dissolved in the brine. Like, so they pump water into the salt deposit. Oops, excuse me for that noise. People will pump water into a salt deposit and then evaporate that salty water off, and then you can form it into really coarse, chunky crystals, and they call that rock salt, but it's a misnomer. It's actually not a rock salt. It's an evaporated salt.
So I was actually correct.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
And then it's a descriptive word because it's rocky-looking.
Okay.
But an actual rock salt is hauled out of the mountain as the mineral halite.
Yeah, it's a rock.
And what a funny irony is about the Himalayan salt we're talking about here that's used to make Himalayan salt blocks is because the word sea salt is such an attractive term, it sounds healthy and natural, and people love the word, and it makes people feel like they're using a more natural salt, even though it's maybe not always the case. But what's funny is that many people will call Himalayan salt Himalayan sea salt. So you'll see that very commonly written in a jar of Himalayan salt.
Like a lot of caves and mountains, right?
Well, the funny part about it is, in fact,
it's not even Himalayan.
Well, no, hold on a second. Let me go all the way through this. In a very real sense, that Himalayan salt is sea salt in a way, because the salt deposit was formed when that part of the earth was underwater, and under salty water for that matter as well. So in fact, when it became
right.
part of a rock deposit, then it became a rock. But in fact,
yeah.
it was originally, in fact, exactly that. It was salty water in the sea.
And originally all rock was lava. So you could call all salt, all rocks lava. But it's not actually true. And you can also say that all human beings are actually just stardust.
You can say a wide variety of things.
We have more definitive definitions for things that are helpful.
What you're telling us is, we're just going to go on the assumption that you're telling us that the purpose of using salt blocks for grilling, chilling, searing, and serving is not just for dramatic presentation. There is actually a flavor and a texture element to all this.
Absolutely, it absolutely makes many foods you cook absolutely taste better than any other cooking technique you can use.
All right, now I think I wanted to mention, just in passing here, that this is a pretty thorough, it's probably the only thorough reference book on doing all these things that I mentioned on salt blocks, and that you advise the readers on what to look for, how to buy salt blocks, what not to do, such as causing them to explode, how to avoid cracking them, so that you've wasted your $20 on thing. I love this part. You even make suggestions for celebrating the death of a salt block.
Yeah.
Can you actually grind them up into table salt when they're busted?
Yeah, that's one of the many things you can do with them. Over time, as you heat them and cool them and heat them and cool them, they will slowly break apart. And that's not really a tragedy. I mean, eventually it'll break into pieces that you can't use, for their original purpose as a salt block, now a salt bit. And those salt bits, you can do a number of things. But you can crush them up with a hammer, you can throw them in the bathtub, heat them up in the stove on a cookie sheet and toss them with spot prawns and get rock salt seared salt prawns. So you can do a whole bunch of things like that. And it's just a matter of your own imagination, really.
I saw something very interesting, and I want to get a reaction from you about this. You may have thought of it before. I don't think we've talked about it before. When we were in Toledo, in Spain, we were seated together, just the two of us, and chatting, but then we noticed there was a family group at the next table. And they were doing something with a block that looked like coal. In fact, and we asked them what it was, because they kept on putting pieces of meat on it and then lifting it off. And it turned out that it was a charcoal block.
Yeah.
That had been raised to a very high temperature and then brought out.
Cool.
And you cooked your beef, I think it was beef that they were cooking, in little pieces. And instead of dipping it in fondue or something like that, you actually put that on the charcoal block until it was cooked as long as you wanted. And then you picked it off with your little tweezers or whatever they were and ate it. And then you did the same. And then partway through the meal, somebody brought them another charcoal block because the other one had cooled down.
How neat. Well, that's very much the same principle. And the difference with the salt block versus that idea is that the salt actually interacts in a very direct and dynamic way with the food. So not only is it actually seasoning it, the salt's actually reacting with the salt itself, gets into the cells of the, breaks down the cells of the food, and converts those complex proteins into simpler amino acids and basically develops flavor. So there's a chemical reaction as well as a physical reaction, whereas, you know, using cooking on a stone or a piece of charcoal is more just a pure physical reaction.
Got it.
Well, Mark Bitterman, as I started this interview, I said you were always a surprise, or you always have a surprise, actually. I like it best when I say you are always a surprise. So with some trepidation, I ask you this. What are you working on next?
A couple of fun things. One is I'm working on opening a new store location on the other side of town in Portland, Oregon.
Okay.
So one of my physical projects, but on the more culinary side of things, I've been spending a lot of time exploring cocktail bitters.
Oh yeah, they're very hot right now.
Yeah, they're just a lot of fun, and I think that there's enough going on. One of the things that's fun about cocktail bitters is that it gives you a path to looking at drinking culture, kind of looking backwards as you look at sort of pre-prohibition era formulations. And also looking forward as you look at kind of new innovative things. And it's a really complex way to interact with all the beautiful kind of botanicals that are out there in the world.
Oh,
there's
yeah,
so many deep
big,
flavors.
Yeah. There's, yeah, I mean, I, we, people send us samples of these all the time. And,
yeah.
I mean, I tend to enjoy them as they are and don't really put a lot of emphasis on whatever they say that they do, what do you call them, the botanical benefits of them. But although I do know that the Italians have long believed in the digestivo.
They're bitter. Well, yeah,
and they're bitter.
Of, just last Saturday we had a street fair here in Portland, and I did snow cones. I did a salty dog snow cone, which was grapefruit reduction snow cone over shaved ice with fire and damnation bitters. And I also did a 7-Up and bitters snow cone. So we did a bunch of bitters flavored snow cones.
Huh. It sounds wonderful. The interesting thing is, and I'm sure you know this because you know everything, but we did discover in exploring cocktail lore, which we've done on the program several times, the main reason the bitters came into existence in the first place was because the booze tested bad. and you had to do something to overcome the fact that although it had the desired effect from an alcohol standpoint, it didn't taste very good.
That's, you know, it was actually a very nice synergy because at the same time, you know, bitters were, prior to their use in cocktails, were a medicine.
And they were a medicine. That's what I was talking about. And in fact, it went out of favor primarily because there was a shortage in World War II, wasn't it, Robin? Or was it World War I?
I mean,
I think bitters were a medicine, you know, well in the they started off, I mean, you know, hundreds of years ago.
Oh, no, no, I'm talking about why they fell out of favor was not because because there was a shortage of them.
I think it was prohibition that did them in.
Uh-huh, yeah, that's possible too.
The story that we got, and we'll close on this note because we're getting away from the subject. Somebody told us that the early cocktails all used cognac.
Oh, that was
And what happened was not during Prohibition, but during the time period when the French vineyards were totally destroyed by the phylloxera louse. There became a shortage
of cognac
to make cocktails. So as a result, in order to have booze in them at all, they started to use bourbon and other things only because, and that has stuck. But what this person was telling us is that they expected that, in fact, cognac in cocktails was going to make a comeback. So if you want to fiddle around with bitters and their effect on booze, and you want to be modern, I suggest you do it using cognac rather than vodka.
I'm going to have to get to this mojito season first before we start doing that.
Yeah, right. Well, let us know. I mean, I'm really interested in bitters, so I'd love to know what you find out.
And thank you so much for joining us today, and we wish you luck with the new store and with the new project, of course.
Thank you so much. It's great talking to you.
Okay, Mark, ciao.
Ciao, ciao. Bye-bye.
And that's all we have for this week's program. We hope you'll join us again same time, same place next week. And in the meantime,
bye-bye.